You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, February 8th, the Glowy Edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. In the New York studios, we have June Thomas, managing producer of Slate Podcast. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
So before we get going, I have three things to tell you, and I'll tell them to you quickly. One is that we're recording in a slightly different way because my kid is sick. So I'm recording from home, and because I have, you know, DIY radio skills, I am recording myself. So it might sound a little bit different, but we'll go back to the regular way next time. Second, we need a new intern, our awesome and amazing Daniel Schrader. It's time to let him loose and fly free in his life and do bigger and wonderful things. But Daniel, can you tell us what is required of a XX intern? Jump in for a minute.
Yeah, sure thing. So the normal things are you collect topics for the week for them to discuss, and then you do research on the topics that they've chosen so that you can send around information for them to be prepared for the show. And then you attend recordings and help the producer, Vera Lynn, with whatever she needs. And it's a really great opportunity because you learn how to produce, you learn how to research. It's just a great position, and you get to work for four amazing women that I couldn't have been happier to spend my time with.
Oh, thank you. Also, we should say you should be in New York so you can attend the recordings in New York and help everyone out putting the show together. We welcome applicants of all backgrounds. So please apply XXGabFest@slate.com and put intern in the subject line. Okay, our final announcement. We were schooled by our Australian and New Zealand listeners so hard these last couple of weeks. I think for the word regressive, that was the problem, calling them regressive in gender relations. And it was basically like subject line Donald Trump. Like, when your president is not Donald Trump, you can talk to me about regressive. That was the start of the conversation. And then it devolved from there. So we're sorry. We don't know what we're talking about.
On the other hand, it was amazing to learn how many people are listening to us in the Antipodes.
I was just going to say that. Who knew?
We even heard from a couple of New Zealand sheep.
Yeah, don't give up on us, though. We love you. It is really, really cool to hear from you. So don't give up. We'll do better next time. Okay, let's get going. Our topics today. First, the sexual abuse scandal in gymnastics that unfolded in Michigan over the last month. Second, we're going to talk about skincare, our new religion. And third, Jordan Peterson, our new guru for the age of the angry man. And then in our Slate Plus segment, we will discuss Lady Doritos, which aren't really a thing, but became an internet thing this week. But what we'll talk about is the concept of a snack specially designed for women sexist? If you're not a Slate Plus member, you should be. Visit slate.com/XXPlus to start your membership. All right, the gymnastics scandal. The scandal unfolded in Michigan over the last month. 150 women accused Larry Nassar, a gymnastics doctor, of molesting them, many of them when they were very young. They're now older, in their 20s, in their teens. This happened over many years at many institutions, and he was ultimately convicted. And then at the sentencing, Judge Rosemary Aquilina, and I say her name, you don't usually say a judge's name because it was an amazing spectacle that she orchestrated. She allowed dozens of victims, one by one, to read their impact statements to his face while he was in the room, which was amazing to watch. It was streamed. So I'm sure listeners have picked up the basics, but let's just lay some groundwork here. June, do you want to just say, give us a basics of sort of what happened, how many people were involved, just for people who haven't tuned in super closely?
Yeah. So Larry Nassar, he's often referred to as the doctor. He is not an MD. He's a doctor of osteopathic medicine. He was the official team doctor of the USA gymnastics team. You know, he's worked with many Olympics teams. He was also he also had a very high position at Michigan State University and the the faculty or the very highest levels of the MSU faculty, right up to the president, was defending him to the end. For more than 20 years, he was abusing women. In fact, actually, as you said, Hannah, mostly girls, because that's who is involved in gymnastics at the elite levels. And he, you know, more than 265 people, as they said in the newspapers, but women, accused Nasser of sexual abuse. And when he finally came to trial after, you know, years in which there had been some accusations and he had been kept in position at both MSU and at USA Gymnastics, he pleaded guilty. So it wasn't that there was a trial that Judge Rosemary Aquilina was presiding over. This was actually a sentencing hearing where all of these young women testified.
Yeah. Now, the things that were unusual about the scandal, and you've mentioned some of them, one is just the kind of cult of the sports doctor. And you're right. He wasn't, you know, there is a degree you can get in sports medicine. It's odd that he didn't have a degree in sports medicine, that wasn't even his specialty. But how a kind of cult arises around, that was hard for me to get my head around. Like, why would anyone like bow down to the doctor, you know? I think that's a thing. That's a thing. Like, you see it in football, you see it everywhere. It's like they have a sort of very intimate, I mean, Tom Brady's like the most extreme example of this, but like a very enmeshed relationship with the people who take care of their bodies.
Yeah. I mean, it's often in lots of sports, there are these conflicting relationship with doctors. You know, they work with the team doctor who's serving the team, not the individuals, and who, you know, in something like football, often push players to do things that aren't necessarily good for them as individuals, but are possibly good for the team because they're serving the team. And in this case, I mean, heaven knows what was going on. I mean, I think there is this, it is all about elite, that the young women who get to the very top of gymnastics are so motivated and have made so many sacrifices and have put up with so much pain that his treatments, you know, as I say, he was an osteopath, though he is an osteopath. And so, you know, it's manipulation is what they're known for. And so one of the thing that was, is sexual abuse, which is not a treatment. He was giving them intravaginal manipulation. He was fisting them. And I understand why more papers didn't go into detail. I'd never want detail when we're talking about sexual abuse. But in this case, it felt so relevant because it is not the treatment. This is not a medical treatment. For 20 years, he was doing this, and people are either so desperate or afraid, or knowing that they cannot, get in the face of the establishment. They can't book the establishment. They were having to go along with it, or essentially growing up believing that this was what they were supposed to do. And it's just maddening.
Right. Because he had a slightly different approach, and he came in saying, oh, I'm an osteopath. I'm doing a different thing. I wonder if people were like, well, that's just what you do. And he's better because he's different. Like, I was just trying to, the thing with me with this scandal has been trying to wrap my head around how, I understand why the girls wouldn't report, but why is this doctor, considered irreplaceable, right? It's not Bella Caroli. It's not a coach who's been the only person to sort of turn gymnastics around. And as a side note, by the way, there have been a bunch of abuse scandals involving coaches, sexual abuse scandals involving coaches in USA Gymnastics. It's clearly quite a warped culture that seems to attract men who are attracted to young girls, unfortunately. What the hell? There was no other doctor, no other, essentially physical therapist?
Well, it is the cult of the individual, isn't it? That this is the doctor who was the doctor of, these Olympic teams, these Olympic winners. You know, you keep going with the winner. Winning trumps everything in sports. And of course, we know they were winning despite his intervention, certainly not because of it. But that is kind of how it goes in sports. You know, if you're winning, don't change anything. Don't change anything. Don't even change the color of your shirt, whatever. I mean, it's there's so much weird thinking in this world, especially at these really high levels.
Now, June, I know you're a person who is into the Olympics. And so I'm trying to ask this question in the correct way before we switch to the spectacle of the courtroom, which is, it feels to me like our association with gymnastics and sort of who we think of as the girls and the types of bodies and the strengths and everything like that in gymnastics has really shifted over the time he was doing his evil deeds, like over the last 20 years. Like, we used to think of gymnastics girls as kind of little girls who were frail and whose bodies were frail. And it's really not that way anymore. A lot of them are, you know, past puberty. They're women and the bodies are much, much stronger. And so I was thinking about that in terms of this scandal, like this was just an image of just like girlhood and vulnerability. But that isn't exactly where gymnastics is now in 2017, right?
Well, I mean, I think
2018.
You know, yes, there is at the very elite levels, the type of body has changed a little bit since 1997, that women have to be 16 to compete. I mean, they are often post puberty, but their bodies don't necessarily go through puberty because of the way that they train and, you know, what they eat and just their regimen. But certainly the amount of physical strength is much more. I'm not sure that really has changed anything about the power dynamics, though, and about the sort of the kowtowing to the authorities. And I also think, you know, there was a really interesting interview in Slate that Isaac Chotiner did with Joan Ryan, who wrote, you know, Little Girls in Pretty Boxes, which is way back from 1995. But it's about, you know, young women in gymnastics and skating. And, you know, she said, look, the gymnastics program, the gymnastics system is pretty much the same as, you know, what we think of as the grooming process that pedophiles go through. I mean, it's the system is just, again, at the elite levels, you know, when you're looking at like even college gymnasts who are, you know, elite, but they tend to have more normal bodies. But it's not so much about the specifics of bodies, I think. It's about vulnerability and, you know, being beholden to men or not necessarily men, but to authorities in a way that's more so than even in other sports, which I think are also prone to the same kind of treatment and behavior.
I also think that in as much as this is incredibly particular to the culture of gymnastics and elite women's sports, it did also make me think about what these girls had in common with other girls and women who've been abused. And during this whole sort of Me Too moment, I keep coming back to a column that Maureen O'Connor wrote for The Cut a couple months ago, where she argued that, you know, this whole moment, all of the abuse that they'd covered up for so many years is really an outcropping of the shame that our culture feels around sex, and that until we can actually talk about sex, we can't talk about sexual abuse. And if you're, you know, if you're a 14-year-old girl who's been touched incredibly inappropriately, you feel ashamed by it, right? And that is like a really, really hard thing to change. But that just was what stuck out to me about this moment. And obviously now shame is being turned on men. And I'm not saying that's not deserved, but like it just is so obviously ingrained in our culture.
Well, so this is a good way to shift talking about what happened in the courtroom, because it felt like what Judge Rosemary Aquilino was trying to engineer was bigger than the crime itself. Like the way that she was taught, it felt like she was responding to a cultural moment. It was almost Nancy Grace-ish. I mean, it was like, I'm going mm-hmm. to force you to see the ramifications of your work. Like I watched a lot of videos of it as it was unfolding because mm-hmm. it was amazing. Like I've never seen anything like it. It was so moving, for one thing, to see the girls reading their testimonies and to say like, you will not crush me, you know, I will get beyond this. But it was mostly her behavior. Like she said to him at one point, I wish that cruel and unusual punishment were possible, because I would like for people to do to you what you did to other people. And she, you know, it was really amazing to watch, because victim impact statements are relatively new in American courtrooms. Nobody knows what to do with them, how long they should go on, what's the purpose of them. And so she just basically took it as far as she could take it. What did you guys think of the whole courtroom spectacle aspect of it?
Well, I thought I would draw somewhat of a distinction between the victim statements and her speaking. I found the women and girls talking incredibly powerful, and I salute her for allowing that and pressing it to become more and more of a thing. However, her own sort of self-aggrandizement is what it essentially her speech is felt to me like a little bit of self-aggrandizement, that she was taking this moment to make herself a hero, to make herself a crusader. And I just found it a little bit inappropriate coming from the bench. Obviously, it's different in a sentencing than during the trial itself. Still, I salute her impulse, and part of her execution, but I was a little turned off by her own contributions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when she encouraged, not terribly subtly, prison rape, or essentially said that she hopes, I mean, her actual quote was, "I would allow someone or many people to do to him what he did to others." Essentially, I hope he gets raped in prison, which not cool. That is not okay. I mean, I have big issues with that, but I also, Noreen, agree that the victim impact statements were not only powerful, but really seemed to like have an impact on the women who had lived through this. The act of doing it, at least from what they said, which is what we should listen to, really was cathartic, more than just cathartic, but really changed something inside them.
And you don't think part of the reason this was all fascinating was because that kind of vengeance aspect that she injected into it? Like, I have been thinking about that. If it were a kind of calm, orderly courtroom situation, it would feel a lot like what is happening now in our culture, which is sort of somebody gets called out or we learn about somebody's bad behavior. But the thing that is missing is a moment of kind of direct confrontation and vengeance in a very kind of biblical way. And I feel like that is partly what people found satisfying. It would not have been as satisfying if they had just read their victim impact statements out loud. It would have been sort of moving, but there was something about him having to sit there, him petitioning, please, can I not hear any more of those? And her forcing him in a slightly, you know, one could say like inappropriate way, forcing the whole thing into a place of vengeance, which is what like made it powerful.
I have no problem with her making him sit through it. He should sit through, you know, 20 years of it. I have no problem with that. Just don't glory in the fact that he's going to be sexually assaulted or encourage him to be sexually assaulted. That's not cool.
Well, do you think that the women would not have sort of taken the same tone if she had not been, speaking in that register herself? Like, I mean, if you watch Allie Reisman's, hers, you know, she's quite famous. That's a clip that made the rounds a lot. And she addresses Larry very directly. She's very angry at him. Do you think that she just would not have done it that way if the judge hadn't set up the courtroom in the way that she did?
It's hard to say because I think probably, I mean, there were how many women who spoke? It was a lot. Like, I think on the docket it was 70 or 80 moves, or I'm not sure if they all spoke, but that's the number of people who could have spoken. Cause there was 150 victims, but not all of them spoke in the courtroom. I think that, there could have been many tones, I suppose, and many ways of viewing the story and many ways of seeing how it had affected you. And I'm sure for each person it was different. And so I think to allow anger is fine and appropriate. Like, I think it would have been worse if the only tone in there had been sort of sad and destroyed. Mm-hmm. Like, that would have made me feel worse if it was just a lot of people that he just kind of ground down into the dirt. So I have to say I was happy to see some of the kind of rise back up energy in the courtroom, which was driven by her. But I'm not sure. Like, there was just something odd about her just kind of orchestrating, like bringing the young women in and orchestrating this. I don't know.
I don't know. Like, the anger feels really appropriate to me. I mean, it's not only at him, the you know, the ultimate perpetrator, but at all these other institutions that, you know, we've seen these cases in the last couple of weeks where women who were abused by him, sexually abused by him, long after the first accusations had come in, and not like one or two, but like dozens. And he'd been, you know, there'd been stories in newspapers and he was still being allowed to have sessions with young women. Like, there is some very justifiable anger. And like, I think there's a stage at which, like, you can't go past certain points, but anger feels entirely reasonable.
Well, also, Hannah, I've been thinking about this as a journalist, how you present these stories, you know, and obviously a judge is different than a journalist, but she was acting as an advocate in that moment. And I happen to think that, like, the best thing you can do as an advocate is get out of the way of people to tell their own stories. Like, in the past week or so, there was this Maureen Dowd article in which Uma Thurman told her story of being abused by Harvey Weinstein. And there was so many distracting details in the story. And that's obviously not the same thing, but it turned the attention a little bit away into this meta narrative about, like, how Maureen Dowd had presented the story and why had she written in this glossy magazine kind of way. And then in this instance, the story becomes, oh, is this judge going to, like, run for something? Is she going to be the next crusading, like, politician? And I just think that it's not the moment to be self-aggrandizing when you're trying to tell these people's stories.
That's such a good point.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And I just want to say, like, one more note of hesitation, because in general, honestly, I thought it was, like, a beautiful, beautiful moment. Like, it just, like, I cried listening to these testimonies, hearing them on the radio. It was kind of an amazing moment and very different from what you normally hear. So I don't wish it didn't happen. But there is another element of these victim impact statements generally. There's a woman named Susan Bandis, I think is how you pronounce her name, B-A-N-D-E-S, who's done a lot of work on victim impact statements. I've looked at them and sort of what their impact is. And generally, what has been found since victim impact statements have come into courtrooms is that they tend, because there are, like, video companies that make videos of victims that they play in the courtroom, is that they have over time kind of created a sense of the perfect victim. So, for example, white victims over black victims, young women over older women, better looking women. I mean, it's just like there is a sense in which the courtroom is now orchestrating a sense of, like, who we in the culture think of as, like, the perfect vulnerable person. And, like, we've seen this echoed on television. We've seen it echoed on, you know, whose deaths and victimhoods gets covered in the newspaper. So that's, like, another, like, tiny note of hesitation I always have when you create sort of grand spectacles of sort of young women in this position, that it does kind of ripple out and echo and have effects. It's not to say I don't think it should have happened. It's just it's just, like, a little footnote in my head about a huge spectacle like this.
Totally. And that's important to say. However, it's impossible for it not to be a spectacle when you've abused so many people.
Yeah, that's true. 150 people is a lot of people. And sometimes with their mothers in the room. I mean, the whole thing is just so horrifying. Okay, well, let's just end it by saying it was, in fact, amazing. And if you haven't seen it, everyone should tune in, watch a few videos. They're all readily available, and they're very powerful to watch. So you should tune in and watch one or two if you haven't.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So now on to skincare. Skincare, wow, we all noticed this kind of at the same moment, all three of us, how it's this new religion, virtuous art. I'm not even really sure what to call it. It's kind of the words you now read associated with skincare are like clean, natural, organic, a part of healing, regaining control. We discuss how skincare became a kind of religion. Now, I've said this to you guys, but in my mind, it kind of registered the way food registered at some point, where I realized that there was a correct way to be about food, and that, like, food had to become something I thought about and cared about in a serious way. And all of a sudden, like, it creeped up slowly on me that skincare was like that, too. So I'm going to ask you personal questions first. I'm guessing that June does not give a shit about skincare.
No, I'm afraid I feel like somebody who... I feel like everybody's like the adults in Charlie Brown cartoons going woop woop woop, and I don't understand. But I'm very curious. It's not because I'm a lesbian. It's just because I'm lazy. It's because
June has nice skin, by the way.
It's not awful. It's not good. I'm sure it could be decent if I put some time in. But, like, I'm too lazy. When I read about, like, hour or 2 hour regimes and 10-step. My evening, like my end of day routine, is a 1-step, like brush your teeth, go to bed. That's it for me.
So Noreen, is this, tell me your relationship. Like, do you go down, you know, Glossier holes? Like, what is your relationship with skincare? Do you have any Korean skincare products, Korean beauty products in your shelf? Like, how deep have you gone, or how much has this entered your life?
I'm curious about this before Noreen speaks, because Noreen truly has magnificent skin.
Oh, thanks, June. I am interested in this intellectually. I care about skincare. I have a different approach than the typical one on the internet right now. So what people are doing now is they're like going to Reddit and they're deep reading the comments in Sephora and they're trying a million things they're ordering from Korea. And it's like slather on serum, serum, serum. I believe in the power of dermatology and sunscreen, and like one product with like a not a lot of chemicals in it is how I feel about skincare. And I recently introduced a retinol, which I would be happy to talk about offline with anyone. But I think that, yeah, I care about my skin. But this like hobbyist way of looking at right. it is very interesting to me. And actually, I'm not sure it's all about organics. It's like the culture is all about organic and lack of chemicals now. But people are just putting crazy stuff on their face and just layering it on. And I think it's more about it's like a hobby. It's fun. Mm-hmm. It's about self-soothing. It's about Instagramming the mask of it. It's like... it's gaming the system, right? It's
right.
like, I think information was a key thing that you said, June, that all of a sudden, you know, you can figure out like what people think about this crazy Korean skincare product or this French drugstore thing. And like, you are going to figure out the system just a little bit better than anyone else.
But it's not like makeup. It's not like, it's very different from no. the sort of type of people who talk about it or the way that people or the pride that people take in it. It's not the same as like, I found the perfect makeup or I have, highlighter, like my highlighter is perfect or whatever. That's like a conversation that you're like a little bit embarrassed about. But this one, people are just like super proud.
Yeah. And it's funny because I always thought, I mean, again, I'm so ignorant here. I'm embarrassed by my ignorance, but I always kind of figured, oh, skincare, you have to, when you really get into that, because you've damaged your skin with makeup. And like, that was everything I was thinking. And it's like, no, it's about like a regime for a regime's sake. It's clearly, it's about looking good, that's a key part of it. But it's also, it is, you know, it's not just that people say it, but given how much time they're putting in, care and all these words that we've used, self-soothing, you know, it's a form of therapy, which is certainly not free, but it's just like taking control.
Well, I also think it's a shift in beauty norms.
Yeah.
I, you know, the ideal here is like glowy, natural glow,
glowy.
Super health. Glowy is a huge word. Like, so Amanda Hess wrote a smart column a while back for the New York Times Magazine about how no one talks about anti-aging products anymore. That's like an embarrassing thing to say. You know, Botox is super embarrassing now. It's all about having that natural or sun-kissed, like I eat kale with every meal kind of look to your skin. And, you know, not having to wear a lot of makeup. The Glossier, which is this hugely trendy millennial focused brand, that's their whole thing. It's like you have good skin and you put in just the tiniest bit of something to highlight that.
Don't you think just underneath that is a sense that you can control time? Like there's a little bit of anxiety or denial or something about the inevitable that underlies this, like you should start your skincare at 32. And that will sort of prevent bad things from happening. Like the thing that got a lot of attention recently was those face exercises, those like medically tested. It was in the New York Times. You do these face exercises, June, this will kill you, but it's like for something like 30 minutes or something. And they are they had these amazing before and after pictures of doing these, you know, they're face exercises. You like massage your face at different points. And it's supposed to somehow halt time. I don't know. Whenever I read it, I think it has something to do with the Trump administration. Like I feel that kind of anxiety underneath of like everything's out of control and I'm going to get the impossible under control, you know, by putting donkey milk or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think it's about control. And I definitely feel like, sure, you know, whatever, nobody ever says this out loud. But clearly, you know, avoiding signs of aging is not going to be a bad thing in the workplace. I mean, there are all kinds of rational reasons. And it's also all these other things. It's also a hobby. It's also interesting. It's also a rabbit hole.
I think it's about the age of inequality. This is the you know, what everyone wants to look like now is like a rich lady. And
yes,
people are going to get in my email and say, oh, you can buy this serum for $8. That's a dupe of that expensive one. But actually, all these products add up and people are, I mean, no one used to, I mean, you know, like upper middle class ladies used to like slap on a moisturizer and call it a day. And now it's like hundreds of dollars of products mm-hmm. for a lot of people, especially if you're experimenting. And so I think the beauty ideal has shifted to someone who can be like a Gwyneth Paltrow and like can just like play around with her face as a canvas and look great at the end of the day because she has access to, you know, healthcare and dermatology and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about age and I just did, but it's also clearly about avoiding the working class body, which, you know, as a working class person, I feel qualified to say definitely exists.
What do you mean by the rich lady thing? Because I've been thinking about how this is actually more oppressive than makeup. Makeup seems sort of democratic and equalizing to me. It doesn't seem that difficult. This seems full of like secrets. Like I've always thought about really rich ladies, not regular rich ladies, but like really rich ladies, that the difference between them and us, you can tell in casual time. Like anyone can dress up and look really good for a night, but there's a way in which like their casual wear is so much more cashmere-y and beautiful than my casual wear. And that's when you can tell the difference. And I've always thought like it is some, it's like that way in which you can go to the spa and spend it. Like this seems like more difficult to me and less fun. but I can get into a hobby. I mean, you mentioned a hobby, like what's the hobbyist element is what? Is like hacking?
Yeah. I think it's like, you know, when a man shows you his record collection and it's like, oh, I got this, blah, 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 mm-hmm. no one else has this. And I think there's an element of that where it's like, oh, like I went really deep down the r/, that's the Reddit, / skincare addiction, you know, subreddit. And I went deep into this comment and gamed out that this should be layered on top of that. And it's like, you know, people think you do it this way, but in fact, I figured out a better way to do it. I have the remix to it.
Yeah.
Like, it's that kind of thing, I
yeah.
think.
Yeah. And I think also that, you know, everything is gendered, of course, but there is a very gendered kind of backlash, which I've, you know, has crossed my mind, you know, beauty and skincare and all of these things are, as hobbies, are always dismissed as like shallow and, you know, oh, so you're just being saps, you're being idiots, you're being taken advantage of in a way that like a guy buying, because I don't think women do this much, buying like a $500 watch or, you know, a $1,000 bicycle. Nobody says, oh, you were taken for a ride. They're like, yeah. Oh, let me see the specs on that. And it's a very gendered response. Like, it's not a hobby I would be interested in, but I'm also not interested in bikes or watches.
I mean, the other aspect of it that people might bring up is vanity, right? Like, I'm not totally convinced that everyone suddenly looks better in this era of, like, adding, you know, a 20-step process to your nighttime routine. But that's the other criticism that people make, like, this is just women being vain, to which I would say, you know, that's unfair that, like, the culture throws this at us and, you know, like, this is kind of a natural response. Also, like, it's okay to want to look good and skin. Like, I actually had a few years ago, right when I was starting a new job, I had a terrible allergic reaction to something that lasted for months. And I was, like, my skin was bad and it just, like, in a way that it had never been in my life. And it just like got in my head in this really horrible way. So I do have a lot of sympathy for people who think it's actually an emotional thing and that there is a sort of confidence case to be made for doing this kind of thing.
And, you know, whenever there's a discussion of, you know, whenever a discussion of skincare starts, you always hear from people who would say in their own terms, look, I have bad skin. I have to do a 10-step process.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a piece in The Outline recently that's set off a lot of discussion. And the author made a sort of, parenthetical comment like, and let's face it, you know, we only whisper it, but some of these people don't even have the best skin. You think, well, duh, it's like, yeah. They're doing it because they feel a need to have better skin because it is all about, you know, being your best, being confident. There's no, like, why would anybody not take steps to overcome something that is causing them insecurity or just feeling bad? Like, yeah, if there is a way to take care of it that doesn't break the bank, why wouldn't you?
But it does buck other wellness trends. Like we talked about this a little bit before, that like you're just slathering chemicals on your face. Mm-hmm. In no other aspect of modern life are we like, you know what we should do? We should industrialize it. We should like see what we can do to make it less natural. And that's what's a little bit wild to me. Like it just again, this is like our / Noreen skin, but you know, like simpler is usually better for me and I have sensitive skin. That's my big question with people who are like showing all these, you know, crazy things they're trying. Doesn't it make them break out? Like, is there such a thing as too much skincare?
You know, Hannah, I'm aware that you haven't really talked about your skincare routine. How many steps are in your routine and how much snail serum?
Well, I'm a donkey milk girl. No, I have no idea what donkey milk is. You know, here's my thing, and I will answer that question, and then I have a question I want you guys to answer for me. I just feel my mom's a big skincare person. She's always, you know, this product, that product. She's always trying to sort of like push the product on me, and I enjoy it. I got no problem with the nighttime product thing, but I just in my soul feel the futility of it. It's like every time I put on skincare, you know how you're at the airport and they're like, the moving walkway is ending? That's what I feel like. I feel like they've just like, I'm like, why? Like, I'll do it. Like, I'll spend my time. It smells good. It's like a tiny moment of pleasure, but I can't get into the groove of like, this is actually, you know, gonna keep me younger, or like time is so much more powerful than any peptide you're gonna put on my face. And so I do it just because it's like that's what girls do and I like things that smell nice, but I can't get into the belief of it, and that's what I'm jealous of in this moment. Like I want to be a believer, but I don't know how to do that, you know? Like there are young women I work with now who are like all the like 20-step Korean routine and this, that, the other thing, and like brought me like a huge bag full of products and it was super fun. But like I don't have the faith.
It's a weirdly young phenomenon. That's the thing that struck me. I was at like a work party the other night and all these girls in their 20s were sitting around talking about their like skincare routine. And like, I don't know. I don't think you need it at that age. That it can be this sort of fun hobby because you actually don't think you're going to die in your 20s, right? That doesn't hit till 30. And that's when you need a real skincare routine. Right. That's what I think.
All right. A last thing I want to ask you guys, if you can solve this problem for me. So there is one part of my brain that feels sad about this because I think, oh, like it's just yet another way in which women have to like work really hard and spend a lot of money on their physical appearance. And that's like we always find a new way. It's like, so if we get rid of sexy, we get rid of, you know, we get rid of makeup. Now we're into natural, but natural turns out to be like a real pain in the ass and also really expensive. So that's like one side of my brain. And the other side of my brain is thinking, well, okay, here is the one time when we're doing this and it's fun and like chicks really like it, but it's not actually about looking great because I'm not sure that any guy is going to, it's not for men necessarily because no guy is necessarily going to say like, wow, those peptides are really making you glow. You know, it is actually genuinely a woman to woman beauty situation. And so that's kind of inspiring about it. Like no dude, I mean, I shouldn't say no dude, maybe some dudes care, but I think in general, it's like information shared between women about women and their own bodies.
Yeah, But I mean, yes, I want to sign on for that. But don't you think women reinforce beauty standards more than men in general? Like women policing each other's kind of looks that and sort of, you know, requiring the product layer on. I don't know. I'm a little less like this is a, you know, this is the sisterhood in its best version.
Yeah. You know, now that you say that, I remember that decades ago, I had a friend who, you know, just had that super, super problem skin, you know, just complete eruption all the time. And it was the only time that people have ever come up to me and said, hey, I noticed your friend has really, you know, has she tried? Like, first of all, don't ask me. But it just seemed odd that it was something that people felt not only like they would, you know, the people who came up to me were genuinely trying to help. And they genuinely thought that, like, she cannot go on in life without my intervention. Like, it does feel like something that, you know, and that wasn't about selling product. That was just like, I really want to help you with this. And that is another aspect of the woman to woman part of it.
That's true. That's true.
Our faces, ourselves. All right, listeners, well, if you have a skincare routine or ideas about skincare, especially if you have belief about skincare and you want to evangelize to me, to all of us. Please write us at XXGabFest@slate.com or go onto our Facebook page and post your note there. We would like some skincare advice.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
All right. Our third topic. Jordan Peterson is a University of Toronto psychologist with millions of viewers on YouTube. He delivers somber lessons to young men about respect and discipline. And I would say he gives them a lot of love. He's like, you guys don't have enough love. I'm going to give you love. It's a tough love situation, but he's insanely popular. And he has come to feel like the guru of this age. So let's hear a few words from him.
People who don't grow up don't find the sort of meaning in their life that sustains them through difficult times, and they are certain to encounter difficult times, and they're left bitter and resentful and without purpose and adrift and hostile and resentful and vengeful and arrogant and deceitful and of no use to themselves and of no use to anyone else and no partner for a woman, and there's nothing in it that's good.
First, for people who haven't heard him or read his book, he has a new book, 12 Rules for Life. So let's talk about some of the Jordan Peterson exhortations. Some of the let's talk about some of his rules for life.
I was very struck by discipline, courage, and self-sacrifice because I was reminded of a series of lesbian novels by Radcliffe about a relationship between the first daughter and the head of her Secret Service team. And those were all about discipline, courage, and self-sacrifice. And they were very, very inspiring. And so I could, for a minute, I was able to see what Jordan Peterson's acolytes see in his message. But then it all passed forward after that.
Yeah. I think most of his acolytes are really thinking about lesbian novels.
Lesbian romance novels, yeah.
Well, so a lot of his rules for living are very sort of sensible. Like if you just read them without his explanation, you're like, yeah, your life is better when you only surround yourself with people who want the best for you or sit up straight. Like, sure, I can sign on for that. But then it's when you go into his explanations for it that you understand that his worldview is actually quite like Nietzschean, sort of like individual strength over everything else. That it's actually just the kind of worldview that really gets under my skin, mm-hmm. to be honest.
Because it's fascistic.
And that, in fact, he's not, when he says, you know, surround yourself with people who want the best for you, it's not like people who care about your emotions. It's like people who will be on your level and pushing you to be better and greater. It's like not actually friendship or caring. It's like, rising tide kind of thing.
Hannah, I feel like you are the person who has studied, perhaps I'm wrong about that, but I feel like you're the person who has spent most time with Jordan Peterson's message. And I'm curious what you have taken from it.
He is playing an interesting game because, like Noreen said, you know, a lot of it is so basic, you know, like apparently, you know, the thing that people most listen to is clean up your room, you know, I don't even know if that's a metaphor when people respond to that term, sort of Reddit people
no.
respond to clean up your room, or if, because it simultaneously could be painting his supposed audience in an incredibly insulting way, like you literally are guys living in your mommy's basement, and so just clean up your room, in which case all he's doing is substituting the kind of horrible, eternal, you know, oppressive feminine mommy for a daddy, you know, and then that's all he's doing. Or if you can take the message if you take it as a metaphor, clean up your room, it's respectful. You know, he's essentially saying this is wartime. Like, you know, we live in this age of sort of extreme rights and freedoms. We've devolved into chaos. Chaos, by the way, is the eternal feminine. That's the three of us. We're triple chaos. So chaos, we've devolved into chaos. And instead of, you know, essentially sitting and whining like little bitches, although he never talks like that, he's not very like modern, right? He talks very like somber and straight. Instead of whining, just like be a man. You know what I mean? Like, stand up straight with your shoulders back is literally one of the things that he says.
Yeah, the writer who wrote about him for New York Magazine called it respectability politics for NEETs. And NEET stands for not in education, employment, or training. It's a British term that has been reclaimed by sort of, you know, Reddit dwellers on the internet who are presumably not the same Reddit dwellers on r/skincare.
But I don't think that's true. Like, I always feel that that's like limiting and tiny. Like, when we say that, like, he has had deeper cultural impact than like the people who are out of the workforce, you know. That's a relatively, I wouldn't say it's too big. It's bigger than it's ever been historically, but it's not, it's like his appeal is more broad.
But that's the specter that he's playing off, though.
Yeah,
it's like, if you don't shape up, you'll be
that person.
Yeah, don't. And he's like guiding people toward a different path.
Yeah. Did you guys watch the video of him going back and forth with the British?
Yes.
So I was fascinated by this video. It's sort of very focused in on feminist issues. They go back and forth for a long time about equal pay, and I suspect a lot of what his appeal is to people who are really into him is that, so he sees the big enemy in life not as women, not as, you know, people of color, but as like the Marxist jargon that has found its way into the universities and into HR departments and the thought police and the PC police, that to him is the enemy, right? And so in that way, he shares some DNA with the alt-right. He is vehemently opposed to Nazism, and he says racism and all kinds of things. But so the trick that he performs is that he brings this like hyper-logical, I'm citing studies kind of thing. Like she brings up the pay gap and he says, well, you need a multivariate analysis. You know, you need to like be looking at these different factors. And so he performs the guy. She's doing the sweeping, angry social justice warrior thing. And he gets to perform the role of like, no, you're not being logical. Like, in this moment, I'm not prejudiced. I'm just hyper-logical. And that, I think, to a lot of people is like weirdly intoxicating, that he's pushing back against this like, you know, the tyranny of progress. Like he gave this amazing quote to our reporter at New York Magazine, Max Reed, that, you know, rights are of course important, but we've been talking about rights for 60 years now. Like, can we stop already?
Yeah, that interview couldn't have worked out better for him. It wasn't actually a skillful interview. Like, she did create straw men. She was not listening to what he was saying. She was not nimble. Like, there was a lot of ways in which she just didn't hear him and just kept trotting out. So you're saying women have to stay home and take, like, he was saying no such thing, right? And so she was she was easy for him to step all over. But what was interesting to me is like why people attuned to that video. Like there was a sense that people were wanting to believe some of his message and wanting to find the kind of kernel of reasonableness and resistance in him. Like, people were kind of silently rooting for him, and not just neat people, but there was a way in which people wanted to believe that he had a point, you know, and that his point was like people that men should that men should make themselves like what's the kind of respectable thing he is saying, that men should make themselves suitable partners for women.
Yeah. And he took great pains to say that he had advocated for women to make more money, and that, you know, it was he just takes great pains to make sure that he's on the record, on the right side of history. And the people who are responding to him, you know, so Connor Friesdorf, who's like one of the sort of house conservatives at The Atlantic, loves him, you know, sort of talked about how the woman who was interviewing him represented the worst of all internet tactic, you know, internet era argumentation. And David Brooks loves him, like these sort of traditional establishment conservative types like him. But he is really a creature of the internet, right? So this book that he's now on this big press tour for, it began as a viral Quora answer where he had 40 rules for life, right? And so he has this like YouTube channel. He's sort of not that well known in academia, but he happened to embrace technology and found this audience who were like, yeah, your random like quoting of studies about how lobsters show how like people are hierarchical in nature too. Like that sounds great, right? So he's found this alternate path to the mainstream.
So he is an odd, he doesn't feel like a modern person. You know, he is an odd mix that way of someone who is taking advantage of modern tools, doesn't feel like a modern person. It's a little fascistic, like the way dictators use modern tools to spread eternal messages. And then if you peer closer, like he's not that... he doesn't have really original ideas or anything like that. It's a lot of the alt-right natural hierarchy. That's the his sort of underlying philosophy seems to be Nietzschean, like the world isn't chaos, and you need to, we're in wartime and you need to stand up and fight and be soldiers. And the second part of it is the natural hierarchy, like there is a hierarchy, you know, men have a role, women have a role, and that's the part he doesn't explore really that forcefully, because it would force him to take kind of unacceptable positions. But he does, I think, believe that hierarchies are natural. I don't know if he then believes that like women shouldn't work and they should stay home and make babies, but that's often the natural end of that argument.
And there's a lot of like Jungian archetypes in his, you know, like chaos is the eternal feminine, and you know, like I think that plays into like men are like this, women are like this when you're in archetype territory.
And he also he refuses to use preferred pronouns.
Yes.
He's transphobic. He is certainly not he's extraordinarily insensitive and offensive when it comes to transgender people.
Yeah, and he's circulated you know, sort of extremely alt-right seeming memes about Muslims in addition to trans people. He seems not great on that issue. He has perpetuated a conspiracy theory that Google populates the first page of results when you Google bikini with bigger women. It's like he's a little sly, kind of crazier than he plays on TV.
Sometimes I think he's like a response to Milo Yiannopoulos. We're like, oh, that one didn't work. He was too cuckoo, you know? So we're going to, it's basically essentially exactly the same message, but we're going to take it in kind of sober professorial form now.
Or like remember James Damore, the Google guy? Like that guy was citing all kinds of studies, right? Or even Andrew Sullivan making arguments about gender essentialism in New York Magazine. Like, you know, he's occupying that, like the rigorous scientific, like Milo's a provocateur. I think this guy is like a grown up, like clubbable version of James Damore.
And I will say there's nothing that makes me angrier than gender essentialism. It drives me crazy, and especially the certainty about gender essentialism, because even if you want to be a gender essentialist, you have to be honest and admit that you have no idea. Right? And that you're picking and choosing the way people pick and choose from the Bible. It's like, you don't know. Like, you weren't there. We have no idea what the gender dynamics were or which ones are shifting. And you can't just choose, like, oh, I'm going to chuck this one, but I'm going to keep this one. This one has been around forever in history. It's very, very based on very little information.
Yeah.
So listeners, if you have listened to Jordan Peterson and think there's a great alternative out there, please send us your alternative guru. We'll have an alternative guru contest and see if any of them fit the bill. XXGabFest@slate.com.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Let's move on to our recommendations. June, you want to go first?
I do. Before I get to recommend my recommendation, though, I just want to mention another Slate podcast. Hang Up and Listen is... If you only listen to one sports podcast, let it be Hang Up and Listen. Josh Levine and Stefan Fatsis have the most amazing, progressive, fascinating, challenging conversations about sports, and the Olympics is coming up, so I'll be paying extra attention. Hang Up and Listen every Monday afternoon. And my recommendation this week is maybe an odd one. I have watched every episode of Law & Order SVU. I couldn't for a minute remember what it stands for. Special Victims Unit. It's kind of an exploitative show, but it has got, and it's not been the best season. You know, the current team is definitely not the best. But there was a recent episode about, you know, a basic kind of, you know, the typical SVU storyline. Someone's raped, challenges her rapist. But it felt very different. It was like a Me Too episode, Me Too era episode of SVU. And in a way, it's kind of like the Judge Rosemary Aquilina sort of situation, in that it's not how most of the world works. Most of the world, the real world that is, would not just, you know, embrace, and that we wouldn't have the police and the DA just doing whatever they could to support this woman and to get justice. But it's kind of fascinating to watch SVU in this current cultural moment. And the recent episode Flight Risk that originally aired on January 17th was particularly interesting in that regard.
I've actually never seen that show.
Oh my God.
Neither have I.
Oh my God.
Not a Law and Order person.
I know. I hate procedurals, but I know. It's, everybody loves it. I'll watch it for June's, in honor of June. Okay. I have a couple of recommendations. The Onion podcast, A Very Fatal Murder. Oh my God, is it funny? It basically makes fun of everything that I do in my other podcast life, like all the conventions of kind of storytelling podcasts. And I mean, it's a parody of Serial, but it's just so funny. It is so funny and well-written. So I want to recommend that. Everyone should tune into it. And second is an amazing article in The New Yorker, which we almost talked about, by Jill Lepore, who's always so great, When Barbie Went to War with Bratz. It's about a legal war between Barbie and the Bratz dolls, but it's about so much more, just culture battles, hashtag Me Too, workplaces. It's such a clever window into a giant, huge world. So everyone should read it if they haven't already. Noreen.
I have two quick recommendations. One, that has, I think, been partly responsible for the skincare obsession. It's a little bit of log rolling, but New York Magazine's The Strategist website is just really good. It's a shopping website, but it's smart, and they have great taste, and they go insanely deep on rabbit holes, like the 30, you know, Korean skincare products under $20 or whatever. It's just fun to read and has tone in a way that a lot of shopping sites don't, and is price conscious. So New York Magazine's The Strategist. And then I'm like really late to this, June. I'm sure you've either recommended this or hated or whatever. but the BBC podcast In Our Time with Melvin Bragg. What's your relationship to it?
Too, yeah. Complicated.
Well, I'm new to it. It's like everyone else did their college course podcast years ago, and I'm in that phase of my life. So he takes a subject like Cicero or cephalopods or cephalopods, as he says, and assembles a panel to talk about them. And the thing that's great about him, and I think not a patronizing way, is that there's always a woman or many women or a couple women on the panel that he assembles. And that's clearly something that he has thought through. So I'll talk to you offline about your complicated relationship to it.
So you'll be much smarter in a month than you are now. We look forward to that. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you to our producer, a wonderful producer, Verilyn Williams, our production assistant, Daniel Schrader. Remember, we are looking for an intern. So please apply XXGabFest@slate.com and put in the subject line intern. Listeners, please subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts. Leave a comment. It helps other listeners learn about the show, and it helps us. So, for June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early, so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.